Okay, we're back for episode 101 of Powers and Principalities. And for this 101st episode, we agreed to talk about the atomic age, nuclear warfare, the atom bomb, so the atomic terror, the Cold War and such. But of course, the atomic age refers to the era of human history that began with the detonation of the first atomic bomb weapon in 1945, and is still with us today. Early on, the era shaped a generation trained in the art of civil defense, spawned a culture now regarded as kitsch, and reconfigured the globe according to who possessed nuclear weapons, nuclear know-how, nuclear materials, nuclear energy, and nuclear radiation. Although nuclear chain reactions had been hypothesized in 1933, the first artificial self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction had taken place in December 1942. The Trinity test and the ensuing bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended World War II represented the first large-scale use of nuclear technology and ushered in profound changes in sociopolitical thinking and the course of technology development. While atomic power was promoted for a time as the epitome of progress and modernity, entering into the nuclear power era also entailed frightful implications of nuclear warfare, the Cold War, mutually assured destruction, nuclear proliferation, the risks of nuclear disaster, as well as beneficial civilian applications. In 1973, concerning a flourishing nuclear power industry, the United States Atomic Energy Commission predicted that by the turn of the 21st century, 1,000 reactors would be producing electricity for homes and businesses across the United States. However, the nuclear dream fell short of what was promised because nuclear technology produced a range of social problems from the nuclear arms race to nuclear meltdowns and the unresolved difficulties of bomb plant cleanup and civilian plant waste disposal and decommissioning. By the late 1970s, nuclear power had suffered a remarkable international destabilization as it was faced with economic difficulties and widespread public opposition, coming to a head with the Three Mile Island accident in 1979 and the Chernobyl disaster in 1986, both of which adversely affected the nuclear power industry for many decades. In 1901, Frederick Soddy and Ernest Rutherford discovered that radioactivity was a part of the process by which atoms change from one kind to another, involving the release of energy. Soddy wrote in popular magazines that radioactivity was a potentially inexhaustible source of energy and offered a vision of an atomic future where it would be possible to transform a desert continent, thaw frozen poles, and make the whole Earth one smiling Garden of Eden. The promise of an atomic age with nuclear energy also as the global utopian technology for satisfaction human needs has been a recurring theme ever since. But Soddy also saw that atomic energy would possibly be used to create a terrible new weapon. Of course, that terrible new weapon was created during the Second World War. The phrase atomic age was coined by William L. Lawrence, a New York Times journalist who became the official journalist for the Manhattan Project. That's interesting. Official journalist. There was one, which, of course, the Manhattan Project first developed nuclear weapons. William Lawrence witnessed both the Trinity test and the bombing of Nagasaki and went on to write a series of articles extolling the virtues of the new weapon. His reporting before and after the bombings helped to spur public awareness of the potential for nuclear technology and in part motivated development of the technology in the United States and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would go on to test its first nuclear weapon in 1949. In 1949, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission Chairman David Lilienthal stated that atomic energy is not simply a search for new energy, but more significantly, a beginning of human history in which the faith and knowledge can vitalize man's whole life. From 1951 to 1962, the U.S. government conducted 100 atmospheric tests at nearby At the nearby Nevada test site, the atomic age phrase gained popularity as a feeling of nuclear optimism emerged in the 1950s, in which it was believed that all power generators in the future would be atomic in nature. The atomic bomb would render all conventional explosives obsolete, and nuclear power plants would do the same for power sources such as coal and oil. There was a general feeling that everything would use a nuclear power source of some sort in a positive and productive way, from irradiating food to preserving it, to the development of nuclear medicine. Let's see here. By exploiting the peaceful means of the friendly atom in the medical applications, earth removal, and subsequently in nuclear power plants, nuclear industry, and government sought to allay fears that the nuclear technology and promote the acceptance of nuclear weapons. At the peak of the atomic age, the United States government initiated Operations Plowshare involving peaceful nuclear weapons. The United States Atomic Energy Commission chairman announced that the Plowshares project was intended to highlight the peaceful application of nuclear explosive devices, and thereby create a climate of world opinion that is more favorable to weapons development and tests. Interesting. Of course, the history of the atomic bomb. The discovery of nuclear physicists in a laboratory in Berlin in Germany in 1938 made the first atomic bomb possible. After Otto Hahn and Lise Meitner and Fritz Strassmann discovered nuclear fission. When an atom of radioactive material split into lighter atoms, there's a sudden, powerful release of energy. The discovery of nuclear fission opened up the possibility of nuclear technologies, including weapons. Atomic bombs are weapons that get their explosive energy from fission reactions. Thermonuclear weapons or hydrogen bombs rely on the combination of nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is another type of reaction in which two lighter atoms combine to release energy. Of course, the Manhattan Project was a code name for the American-led effort to develop a functional atomic bomb during World War II. The Manhattan Project was started in response supposedly to the fears that German scientists had been working with on a weapon using nuclear technology since the 1930s. On December 28, 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the formation of the Manhattan Project to bring together various scientists and military officials working on nuclear research. Much of their work was performed in Los Alamos, New Mexico, under the direction of the theoretical physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. On July 16, 1945, in a remote desert location near Alamogordo, New Mexico, the first atomic bomb was successfully detonated. The Trinity test, it created an enormous mushroom cloud, some 40,000 feet high, and this ushered in the atomic age. Scientists at Los Alamos had developed two distinct types of atomic bombs by 1945, a uranium-based design called the Little Boy and a plutonium-based weapon called the Fat Man. While the war in Europe had ended in April, fighting in the Pacific continued between Japanese forces and U.S. troops. In late July, President Harry Truman called for Japan to surrender with the Potsdam Declaration. The declaration promised prompt and utter destruction if Germany did not surrender. On August 6, 1945, the United States dropped its first atomic bomb from a B-29 bomber plane called the Enola Gay on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The Little Boy exploded with about 13 kilotons of force, leveling 5 square miles of the city and killing 80,000 people instantly. Tens of thousands would later die from radiation exposure. When the Japanese didn't immediately surrender, the United States dropped a second atomic bomb 3 days later. Didn't give them much time. In the city of Nagasaki, the Fat Man killed an estimated 40,000 people on impact. Citing the devastating power of the new and most cruel bomb, the Japanese Emperor Hirohito announced his country's surrender on August 15th, ending World War II. The United States was the only country with nuclear weaponry in the years immediately following World War II. Soviets initially lacked knowledge and raw materials to build nuclear weapons. Within just a few years, however, the USSR had obtained, through a network of spies engaging in international espionage, blueprints of a fission-style bomb and discovered regional sources of uranium in Eastern Europe. On August 29th, 1949, the Soviets tested the first nuclear bomb. The United States responded by launching a program in 1950 to develop more advanced thermonuclear weapons. The Cold War arms race had begun, and nuclear testing and research became high-profile goals for several countries, especially the United States and the Soviet Union. To many observers, the world appeared on the brink of nuclear war in October 1962. The Soviet Union had installed nuclear-armed missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles from the U.S. shores. This resulted in a 13-day military and political standoff known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. The crisis was resolved by President Kennedy negotiating with Nikita Khrushchev. He agreed to remove of he agreed not to invade Cuba, and Khrushchev reportedly agreed to remove the missiles from Cuba in the as the deal. 1970, of course, there was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. It separated the world's countries into two groups, nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states. Nuclear weapon states included the five countries that were known to possess nuclear weapons at the time: the United States, the USSR, Great Britain, France, and China. According to the treaty, nuclear weapon states agreed not to use nuclear weapons or help non-nuclear states capture nuclear weapons. They also agreed to gradually reduce their stockpiles of nuclear weapons with the eventual goal of total disarmament. Non-nuclear weapons states agreed not to acquire or develop nuclear weapons. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s, there were still thousands of nuclear weapons scattered across Eastern Europe and Central Asia. Many of the weapons were located in Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. These weapons were deactivated and returned to Russia. Some countries wanted the option of developing their own nuclear weapons. Arsenal and never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. India was the first country outside the NPT to test a nuclear weapon in 1974. Other non-signatories to the NPT include Pakistan, Israel, and South Sudan. North Korea initially signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but announced its withdrawal from the agreement in 2003. Since 2006, North Korea has openly tested nuclear weapons, drawing sanctions from various nations and international bodies. Now, of course, Joe, that's the, I guess you could say, the official history of the atomic age. More or less pulled that from various sites, including Wikipedia. So it's a standard account. So Joe, what do you have to say about the nuclear age?
Well, it began for me basically on the second day that I was in Japan as a young boy. And at that time, there were kind of wandering people that had been displaced by the bombs. That was kind of a problem, a social problem, because the country was in complete chaos. I guess I was there like 54, only 9 years, you know, after the surrender. So it's still pretty much a mess. And I think starvation was the main cause of death. And so my family got there, and we moved. We were a civilian family. And so we were one of the very first families to not live in like side military compounds after the war. And we lived on a street. There was actually, I'm pretty sure I can recall, like kind of MPs, Jeeps and things, but they weren't really, you know, very often. We were pretty much just there as like regular people in this one little street that wasn't too far from the Emperor's Palace. It was a more kind of upscale area. And on the second night we were there, my mom, who was always with, you know, feeding babies because she had 9 kids over her span as a producing mother, middle of the night, she went to our kitchen to get formula for a baby, I think. And of course, it's formula. And so there, she encountered a thief who had come into our house. And it turned out later on, we found out that he was one of these people who were wandering because of the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. He was from Nagasaki, or the outskirts of Nagasaki. So there he was, he was at the icebox stealing eggs and eating them raw. Okay, so my mother just screamed because, you know, we were all on edge. You know, we'd been warned about, being Caucasians in the Japanese country, and the Japs were kind of upset about the bombs and a few other things, and so we had to be careful. So she just screamed like crazy. So my father was the other side of the house, and he's a huge guy, bigger than me. He's like, I don't know, 250 maybe. You know, he's a big guy, hairy. He had a lot of body hair, and had no clothes on. He was asleep, but he heard the scream. and he came straight through the house to the screen. Now, bear in mind, this is a traditional Japanese house, and they're all shogi screens, right? So he just comes straight through the screen, just one after another, collapsed, came right over my bed and exploded out. And there was this Japanese guy who probably weighed like 80 pounds, right? He saw my dad and attempted to run off, which was like a smart idea. But my dad, being like a, you know, former like fullback or halfback in high school football, he just ran him right down and caught him. So anyway, so the guy was taken to jail, and part of the Bushido culture in Japan, the prisoners would try to make restitutions and communications with the people they had wronged. And so my father and him developed a relationship. And my dad was trying to learn how to write Japanese, and so they would write letters back and forth. And so as he was about to get out, I think a year, he said he was about to get out. My father said, "What are you going to do?" And he says, "Well, I've learned a trade." And my dad wrote, "You know, what is it?" And he goes, "Well, I've become interested in making films." And my father said, "Really?" He says, "Yes, I'm going to, I've decided to make a movie about the night you caught me." And my dad said, "Really? You're going to make a movie about that?" He goes, "What are you going to call it?" And he said, "Godzilla." So this was the beginning. Part of the story is true. I won't tell you which parts, but anyway, so the thing is that when I was a kid, there were lots of people. You know, they talk about like the nuclear age. You know, is it? I mean, is the nuclear bomb real? I mean, there are people that actually pose this question, and I'll tell you the truth. I actually had a discussion with someone. And Tim, for the life of me, I was having a pretty hard time, like, you know, I mean, because remember, there's all the special effects, you know, you have the special effects lookout mountain place in Laurel Canyon, and we know that's obviously propaganda, and they're the ones who are supposedly developing the techniques to film nuclear bombs. So, so there is that kind of theoretical question that's out there, and if you're a skeptic about the government and the secret society, it's a legitimate question. But I personally think there was real devastation from a nuclear weapon, because I saw it as a kid. I actually saw people, there was a lot of, you know, people getting cancer. I mean, this was kind of not I don't think it's something that they could have just put on as a psyop, the actual kind of on the ground stuff in Japan. And so I take the position that it was a real event. And I also know people that claim to have seen the Las Vegas bombs. Okay. So that's my take on it. But anyway, the point I want to make is that the bombs were, what was fake, of course, was what the population was told about the bombs after the explosion. The people were told that the weapons were developed because we were afraid the Germans would come up with them. Evidently, this was one of the kind of things they would tell people. And that we blew up Hiroshima and Nagasaki because the invasion would have taken, you know, 100,000, half million, there's different estimates, you know, all these U.S. soldiers would have died. Okay, so this is the first, you know, moment of, in my opinion, the atomic age, as you pointed out, begins with, you know, Hiroshima. And I would say that right off the bat, you can see that something's completely wrong with the whole storyline, and that there has to be some other reality to the development of the bomb that the public isn't being let in on, because The explosion of the two Japanese cities was completely unnecessary. There was no military reason. The public was being lied to from the very beginning. And I wanted, I hope that this isn't, you know, kind of going too far. I'm not like talking for too long time here, but I wanted to just read some things that I think people should be aware of in terms of the actual, you know, like what the American military leaders knew about the atomic weapons, because this their statements, which are public record, really show that they, I think, are the kind of the first step, in my opinion, to really understanding what the bombs are, what they're being used for. Eisenhower was stated that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives. MacArthur stated that using the bombs was completely unnecessary from a military point of view. The Japanese were already beaten. The cigar-chomping hawk, Curtis LeMay, he said the war would have been over in 2 weeks without the Russians entering and without the atomic bomb. Nimitz, you know, he said, yeah, the bomb played no decisive part from a military perspective in the defeat of Japan. Admiral Leahy, he said, look, he says, I was unable to see any justification for an invasion of an already thoroughly defeated Japan. My conclusion, with which the naval representative agreed, was that America's least expensive course of action was to continue to intensify the air and sea blockade. I believe that a completely blockade of Japan would then fall by its own weight. Now, we've talked about the United States Strategic Bombing Survey. Now, this was a panel of over 1,000 experts. They basically, a third of them were civilians, people like John Kenneth Galbraith, right? So these are at least, if not honest, at least well-known historians. And then two-thirds were just military bureaucrats. They had access to everything, and they actually decided to release this, which is online. This is actually something, you know, people are interested, they can read. They wrote, it's clear that even without the atomic bombing attacks, air supremacy over Japan would have exerted sufficient pressure to bring about unconditional surrender and obviate the need for invasion. Okay, and it goes on to say that Japan would have surrendered before the end of 1945, right? So in other words, like 5 months from the nuclear bomb, they would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. Now, Tim, the reason why that's important is that the number that we're given is part of our socialization as patriotic Americans, right? That, you know, now the number currently is like 500,000 Americans would have died if we'd had to invade. And we had to invade because the Japanese were, you know, they were zealots, right? But here, This was something that, you know, in a 2-year survey, they concluded, the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, who had access to all data, they said, you know, the number would have been zero, right? So you see how important that is? It isn't 40,000 or 150 or 500,000. It's zero. There would have been absolutely no fatalities if we had simply let the Japanese, you know, country collapse of its own weight. Now, there was, to me, the most important statement about it comes from Halsey, Admiral Halsey, commander of the U.S. Third Fleet. And he was the one who was actually the naval blockade guy. He had access to all the information. And now bear in mind, Tim, that the military leaders who just, you know, I was quoting their position on this, this was before the CIA. So they had, so military and naval intelligence was as good as it gets. There wasn't some kind of deeper level of understanding that Truman had, you know, this was as good as it got. They're the ones that briefed Truman on the, you know, what was going on in real time. And so Halsey, Admiral Halsey, stated that the scientists had this toy and they wanted to try it out. So they dropped it. It killed a lot of Japs, but the Japs had put out a lot of peace feelers through Russia long before. Now, this was in parallel with the findings of the Strategic Bombing Survey, who also noted that the Japanese had no interest in committing national harakiri. They wrote, this is in the Strategic Bombing Survey, that the Japanese leaders knew they were defeated. They were secretly willing to negotiate an unconditional surrender. According to the survey, there was instructions from the cabinet to negotiate for peace on terms less than under conditional surrender, but with private instructions from the emperor to secure peace at any price. Okay, so I'm sorry to be long-winded, but that's an important lump of information because it really shows that at the very beginning of the atomic age, the leaders who have created it are lying. There was some other reason than military that the bomb had been developed. And so that's the first thing I want to point out, is just that from the very beginning, the public is being lied to. The atomic age is basically the age of lying about atomic weapons and energy by the secret society.
Yeah, a good book on that topic is The Decision to Use the Bomb. I'm sorry, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb by Gar Alperovitz. It's about 650 pages long. Yeah. Good treatment on the topic, on the politics and decision making that went into using the atomic bombs at the tail end of the Second World War against Japan. Yes, definitely, we're talking about the development of the bomb, the Manhattan Project itself. Of course, the received narrative is that it was a crash program to develop the bomb ahead of the Germans. As you said, the Germans weren't developing a bomb. They were aware of it. I believe it was Werner Heisenberg who told Niels Bohr that very thing. And Niels Bohr apparently got the wrong message and told the Americans that the Germans were interested in developing a bomb. But nevertheless, what was the objective of the Manhattan Project itself and the development of atomic weaponry? There's an interesting article, and I interviewed them, the two brothers, about this, by Paul and Philip Collins. They wrote an article for Conspiracy Archive called Blackmailed by the Bomb, the Call to the Superweapon, and the notion that the secret society, the elite, the Illuminati, the ruling elite were obsessed with sort of developing some type of super weapon that they were able to wield to impose a global world order by this threat. And it seems, after reading the article, it goes into sort of the intrigues involving nuclear proliferation and how elements within the U.S. government have actually facilitated nuclear proliferation vis-a-vis Israel and Pakistan. Throughout the years, and ultimately the Soviet Union too, in the 1940s, and the reasons for this wasn't because some people were probably bribed, or some people for ideological reasons, but the idea was that there are elements within the power structure that wanted to promote nuclear proliferation to create the pretext for a new world order, the same way that the world wars were fomented to create the pretext for a League of Nations and also the United Nations, and ultimately global governance. And the threat of nuclear annihilation would be the pretext for global world government, because the nuclear arms race wasn't particularly blamed on one nation state versus another, but the nation state system itself, sovereign states. The sovereign states were the ones that were at fault for this. They were the ones creating the nuclear arms race. So the only way you have to get around that, the only way to get around that would be to establish a global world order. And this type of situation was foreseen by H.G. Wells, who was rather well connected, and he wrote about this in, I think, The World Set Apart, the book he wrote, where this very thing, he coined the phrase atomic bomb, and also he also wrote the book The New World Order, and they saw that this is the only way to establish global peace was through global hegemony. And the nuclear weapon would do to terrorize the world into the various nations into surrendering their sovereignty, so they can be managed under, a committee, a globalist committee that would take control of the weapons and make sure no one used them. And that you could say that was the esoteric or occulted objective of the Manhattan Project.
Right, absolutely. Well, I mean, first of all, they blow the thing up at a place they call Trinity. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, they just picked that right out of thin air, right? Of course, on the 33rd degree parallel. What's his name? Oppenheimer. He quotes, you know, that, you know, I have become a destroyer of worlds.
Yeah, the Bhagavad Gita or something.
Which is a Sanskrit, you know, saying. But it's like, what world is being destroyed? Well, I guess it's the Trinity. I mean, yeah. That's, they blow it up. So right off the bat, you can see that it's basically a Freemason project to, like you say, I mean, the real purpose of all this is to create the justification for a world order, and so you need the ultimate terror weapon.
And also to create a constant fear, anxiety.
Exactly. And that's why one important thing to remember is that it wasn't developed by the U.S. government. I mean, the Bohemian Grove is the organization that actually made the decision to go forward with the project, and they brag about it now. It was kept secret for a long time. I don't know how it got vetted, but now it's on the Bohemian Grove website. They're actually quite proud of it. And they've said, yeah, they were all members like Oppenheimer and Teller and then GE and DuPont, the heads of these companies were brought in, and they actually came up with the plan to do it, and they just used the U.S. as a funding source, but it was actually their project all along. And Bohemian Grove made the decision to make the weapon, and that makes a lot of sense, because no person representing like a constituency in a democracy would ever vote to create such an insane thing as a terror weapon like this, because there is the chance that there could be proliferation. Do you see what I mean? There's a slight chance.
Like, well, it was almost immediate, because the Manhattan Project was riddled with spies.
Right, but I mean, yeah. Which
and
of course,
I don't think it was subversion. I think this was intended.
Of course, I mean, of course, the whole idea was to create the dialectic, right? Well,
in the article, and I do commend the article. It's a very long article and gets into a lot of ties in a lot of things. The science fiction, the use of science fiction as a thought experiment, as a predictive program, which H.G. Wells was doing, and then this whole idea of a lot of the things we hear about proliferation with the AQCON network receiving assistance from the U.S. government, elements therein, the CIA, to proliferate. And, of course, the pretext for this is the Afghan war and the support in the 1980s when the CIA needed the support of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan fighting the Soviet occupation to give them their Vietnam. And what happened was the U.S. government got wind of, I guess there was at the time, the government was the Pakistani government, who AQ Khan was trying to develop the bomb, and of course to do this they were smuggling all types of weaponry and funding from the Saudis and these things, and the U.S. government detected this and tried to crack down on it. And the U.S. government, there's a thing called the Solars Amendment, basically by Stephen Solar, says any government involved in proliferation will get cut off of all aid. And the Reagan administration actually did this for a little while, then rescinded the decision, despite the fact that they were openly involved in proliferation. And it turns out that there's much evidence that U.S. elements within the U.S. government, the State Department, were actually aiding in this proliferation. It wasn't just people being bribed, that's a part of it, but this was an attempt to actually to proliferate, to spread the fear of nuclear proliferation, to justify world government. Sort of indict the nation state system. The same thing they do with the world wars. They blame the nation states for the world wars. So we have to do away with sovereignty, bring out this world government. And so, again, we have all this, this is being done under the cover of the Cold War and these things, another dialectic, and we can't take the atomic bomb, of course, outside the context of the Cold War. This was done to lead to proliferation. This also leads to, if you remember years back, the Valerie Plame affair, her exposure as a CIA agent by Robert Novak, supposedly, and her work for Brewster Jennings, this CIA proprietary undercover operation that was undercover operation to help engaged in counter-proliferation, reporting on companies, and I guess she was exposed and exposed that operation. But also the revelations of Sybil Edmonds and various other officials, how they were sort of exposed and then their careers were ended because they're actually involved in counter-proliferation. But there's some agency or element within the government that actually wants to promote proliferation. Again, in my theory, just to create the fear and anxiety of it.
Of course, that is the most logical, I think, obvious explanation. And I just wanted to back up because I had another little, data point. I think it might be valuable for people to be aware of, because it really shows how the bomb was simply created for psychological terror from the very beginning. You know, when they were going to, when they're planning to use the two bombs. Well, first of all, I wanted to point out that, you know, they have, it's like, I think they call the two bombs, or at least the public got the names Fat Boy and Little Man, I think.
Fat Man and Little Boy.
Fat Man and Little Boy. Well, you know, that wasn't the original names of the bombs. The original name of the bomb was Fat Man and Thin Man, because one of them was kind of rotund.
Yeah.
And actually, they were named after Churchill and Roosevelt. And so you can see that the Masons were actually, you know, naming the bombs after Masonic leaders from the very beginning. And then, just to completely clarify what the purpose of the bombing was, it is a fact that they had actually had a list of protected cities. They knew they wanted to use the terror weapon for both photographic, you know, documentation of terror, and also for experimentation. And so this was in 1944, and they were going through depopulating Japan, right? They were using incendiary bombs on the city, just like they were doing in Dresden and Hamburg and other European cities. But they were wiping out the Japanese population with napalm, basically, into cities. But they created a list of protected cities. There were five cities, and they were off limit for the express purpose that they needed to be preserved as potential targets so they could do the proper experiment of the new gimmick weapon. So it's a little known fact, but Hiroshima, Nagita, Karura, Kyoto and Nagasaki were not firebombed. Everyone else was. All the other major populations were firebombed. But these five weren't, because they were the ones, which, and incidentally, they would have been the easiest to get at because they were southern. But they were spared this because they wanted to have a clean research petri dish to drop the new terror weapon in for documentation. Now, Hiroshima and Nagasaki... okay, so why were they picked, Tim? You know, what I think is they had the largest Christian populations. Nagasaki had an enormous Christian population. You know, there had been Christian missionaries there for hundreds of years. And so I think there were it was over 50,000 Christians. And in fact, the actual, what do they call it, the ground zero was the Catholic Church in Nagasaki, in Hiroshima, and in Nagasaki. And so I think that this definitely played into the decision. I think it's really unlikely that the two cities with the largest Christian populations would have been chosen for the experiments. I think it strikes me as very plausible that this was just, you know, Freemason, you know, viciousness against Christians that was being expressed in their experiment, and then this shows that it was that they were all that the bomb was always intended to have just a psychological effect, and so that when you had the extraordinary lapse in security, whereby all of the documents supposedly needed to build a bomb got out. You know, you had the Rosenberg situation. You know, this is actually to be expected, isn't it, Tim? Because you had to have the dialectic in order to get the duck and cover generation, that would be my generation, underneath their desk, you know, learning to be frightened and to, you know, to basically... you know, the world is dangerous. We look to the government for security. All we can do is duck and cover and hope that the scientists and the technocrats in the government can protect us. And so, you know, this then I think started to erode the psychology of the American people. And of course, this will then eventually lead to the counterculture.
Yeah, the cultural effects of this. Well, one thing I didn't mention was immediately after the bomb was dropped, there was the Baruch Plan. And that was to internationalize all weapons, and this was what should have been the vision of the elite. But they wanted a international control of nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union balked at it. This was basically their two wings. There's the Pax Americanus and Pax Universalis. And what happened was, I guess they didn't, they miscalculated how the Soviet government would respond to this. And so then you had the new dialectic of the Cold War and the arms race. But, you know, given the fact that the Cold War itself was largely managed, the arms race itself was, well, just sort of, I think wasn't really genuine. I think it was just a sinkhole. The pour this, you know, money into these nuclear weaponry, or claim they're spending the money on nuclear weaponry. Who's to say how many weapons are actually tipped, right? How many arms? Yeah, it's all classified.
I just want to interject that we talked before the show started about, you know, are they real? I mean, I think they are, but I think that it's very possible that
Do you think there are really thousands of them, though? I mean,
yeah, I think that it's very possible that that's just propaganda.
It's like those parades that Soviet Union had with the missiles. Do you think those are real missiles on the back of the truck? You know, it's like, it's all classified. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean,
they use the same ones every year for 30 years. I mean, so, yeah, so the whole thing is absurd. But this is just, agitprop to keep the public scared. And, eventually they'll come, and when they get the population on the psychological and health side weakened enough so that, you know, basically we're all sort of autistic, then they can, you know, the final, you know, dialectic, they'll say, well, we have to have world dictatorship because there's nuclear weapon and terrorism. And it's just, the thing I would hope we can communicate is that terrorism is always something that the alert citizen has to scrutinize closely, because it is the just the routine device that government uses, right, to insist upon greater and greater control over us. And so that's really, to me, the atomic age is really just a chapter in a process. They created the terror weapon. They just scared the heck out of everyone. I mean, honest to God, Tim, you know, I grew up in a different era. I grew up in, like, you know, the 50s, and I spent a lot of that time in Japan, and then I was in the United States. But in my world as a child, like in the, you know, early 60s, we had television. I swear, I think I must have seen atomic bombs blowing up like 10,000 times it was the most common thing. The movies were all about, you know, you have giant ants. Because of the atomic testing, you'd have beetles, you know, that were all 15 feet high. They had like movies, and they always have like a bomb blowing up in these films. They had like the giant woman, like 50 foot high woman.
Yeah, 50 foot tall, the giant colossal man.
All of this stuff is like, this is all part of the agitprop to get us to think that the bomb and the radiation are these just surrealistically powerful thing.
The day the earth stood still, where an alien comes down and tells that they're gonna, you know, take control of the planet unless you all sort these things out, which is like H.G. Wells's vision, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Gort, the robot, you know, with the super weapon.
Yeah. So anyway, that was really, you know, and it definitely had an effect on me. I mean, all the, you know, because remember, you go from like a few hours of duck and covering to going home and seeing the attack of the 50-foot woman. I mean, you know, you go through a few years of that, and I mean, you know, you're pretty well, like, it's hard to have a normal dating relationship.
Well, they did a study on that in cases of anxiety, apathy, narcissism. Psychologists sparked, this was a product of the nuclear age, because people's sense that, you know, within minutes the whole world could be destroyed, so why plan for the future? Why care?
Exactly. Yeah. God, so important to know. Yeah.
And this, you know, you've mentioned duck and cover, and there was this cartoon character, Bert the Turtle, where he you know, dutifully hide in his shell when he heard the atomic bomb was coming. And they had these cartoons you can watch on YouTube now. But this was done with in collusion with the Atomic Energy Commission, Civil Defense Organization, all these things, official sounding organizations producing this ridiculous, you know, cartoon character, you know, telling kids, you know, that, you know, it's like almost like a fire drill. Now you could say, at the time, I guess if you're far enough from an explosion, duck and covering can help, I suppose. But nevertheless, if you watch the shows, it's like an atom bomb can happen. Atom bomb could strike anywhere, anytime, without warning or with warning. You know, what's this doing to, you know, just a cultural effect. You mentioned the movies, of course, but then you also have like Las Vegas, where they had like, they had parties, atomic parties, where they'd watch the explosions from miles away, and the like atomic cafe, and of course you had the candy, atomic fireballs. It's a candy.
Oh God, they had so many movies that, I mean, I remember Panic in the Year Zero.
Oh yeah, of course the beach, right? The beach, was that
on the beach, which on is beach. Very symbolic. They took that from a T.S. Eliot Freemason homage poem, On the Beach, about the apocalypse. There that was, and then of course Dr. Strangelove.
What's funny is in that movie you see kind of the effect of people's, because people, they slowly die, they're doomed, and the radiation's going to get them, and they commit suicide or they become reckless, no concern for the future. Of course, Dr. Strangelove took a comedic angle at this issue.
Notice that, like in Dr. Strangelove, you have an elite that survives.
Yeah.
How obviously, the Dr. Strangelove, we should probably do a whole show on that. It's like, so the symbolism is so Masonic. It's like I am the walrus or something, but you have like General Jack Ripper.
Jack D. Ripper, yeah.
The plan, I think, is just absolutely clear. And in 1953, I think it was, Stalin gave up the ghost, and then you had, Khrushchev. I think there was some, but
Malenkov and Khrushchev, yeah.
Yeah, there was this idea that somehow the Bolshevik, Jewish control Bolshevik sort of, faded into the background. And then suddenly you had Khrushchev, and it really wasn't the Bolsheviks anymore. It was something else. But as far as I'm concerned, the Masonic control over the Soviet Union and the Politburo never stopped. I cannot imagine that there was a coup in 1953 that had any kind of reality to it.
Well, Rockefeller had landing rights all throughout the Cold War.
Exactly.
What do you make of the Cuban Missile Crisis and, the official tale and Castro himself? I mean, you can't, looking at the nuclear atomic, the threat of atomic warfare or nuclear warfare and the Cuban Missile Crisis, were we really on the brink of nuclear war, or was that just a drama play?
That was stagecraft. I'll tell you, I've been to Cuba, and if you go there in Havana, you'll see it's completely dilapidated. I mean, they have no money. Cuban people are just wonderful. Love Cubans. And I like visiting Cuba. I had a really, great time there. I wouldn't really recommend the Communist Party as like a group to control your politics. But in any case, the people are wonderful. But there is almost no military presence, and there's almost no police presence in Havana. There may be some spies, but I didn't see any of that stuff. I just saw like a lot of people trying to make some money because they're broke. But the one building that looks absolutely modern and giant and perfect is the Masonic Lodge. And it went all the way through, and never gave up its status, during any of this. So to me, that's kind of, where Castro comes from and the whole thing. In my opinion, it was more of the stagecraft to dialectic to create, the Cuban Missile Crisis was, just a theatrical production to terrorize people. Gosh darn it, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. Tim, I was duck and covering like two or three times a day, we were terrorized by that whole thing. And of course it just affected us. We looked to our government, Kennedy, you know, he, his popularity went through the roof, you know, I mean, everyone. And of course, the idea of like a military budget, we just wanted a gigantic military, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, think of it. Why would, assuming that the arsenals are ready to go, nuclear arsenals, why would two governments decide to destroy each other over a lousy island in the Caribbean?
Oh, it was absurd. I mean, and the whole thing was, is that, well, we don't want them to have these missiles close to us. Right. Like we could stop the ICBMs, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had an actual friend of mine who was, he was involved with the military. And, you know, remember we had like what's called the Nike military or Mikey missile bases. Mm-hmm. They're still in existence. I mean, they're not being used for like 50 years, but they're still up there. You can go and see them like around Los Angeles in the Malibu Mountains. They had the Nike missile bases. They were going to shoot down the ICBMs. And this guy, this friend of mine, he was actually involved in this. And I asked him once, well, did you have any chance of hitting him? He goes, we had about as much chance of hitting the ICBMs with the Nikes as you would of shooting a BB and hitting a 22 bullet while it was in the air. He said there was just no chance at all. So why would you need to basically blow up the planet to, you know, to keep like missiles being 90 miles away when they had submarines, of course, that could launch. And of course the ICBMs couldn't even be stopped. So again, this is just like the rationale for, you know, go blowing up Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Tim, it's just stagecraft, and the point of the drama is to make us frightened. You know, it's as simple as that. We lose our ability to resist and to think clearly about government and who's running it when we're scared.
It's the same thing like the current fears with North Korea. No one's genuinely afraid of North Korea. It's just a media event every 5-6 months.
Of course. I mean, I think that to me, North Korea is just like the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, but I'm sure they have control over that fat guy with the Elvis haircut.
Well, that, yeah. I mean, the whole regime was set up, you know, by the U.S. and Russia after the Second World War, when it was agreed, you know, hey, you take the North, you know, we take the South, and hey, let's start a war. And that the whole purpose. So again, the whole purpose of the Korean, large purpose of the Korean War was to justify, again, a multilateral international global government, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you pointed out that like they actually gave weapons, arranged weapons to be moved into North Korea and to North Vietnam, mm-hmm. Following World War II. And these were then, you know, basically to create, you know, armies that could create the dialectic, you know, so that everybody is thinking that there is a legitimate, you know, battle of oppositions, you know, I mean, it's like the Vietnam War is another, you know, just, I mean, the atomic bombs didn't really get into that war much, but man, I remember the Korean War, and there was all this fear about you know, nuclear weapons getting used, and so we had to, I mean, I don't know what we had to stand up to the communists for some reason, and then, you know, so the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think, was artificial. And I really do think that the best way to look at the Cuban Missile Crisis is that it's the, you know, it's like the attack of the 50-foot commie. You know, I mean, it was just a movie that they created. I don't think that there's a chance in the world that the Politburo had been somehow was lost the Masonic control that it was exhibiting during Stalin's period. I mean, just look at, for heaven's sake, Stalin, all of the photographs of Stalin with the hidden hand symbolism. I mean, he was just famous for this, you know?
Yeah, I interviewed a while back Servando Gonzalez, who wrote a book about Castro being a fake.
Yeah.
He says Cuba has long been sort of a testing ground for one scenario the New World Order wants to play. One is enforced scarcity, impoverishment.
Yeah.
And Castro himself has an IMBD page. He's a former actor. And he was in the U.S. He's had many unaccounted time in the U.S. He tried to play Major League Baseball. And of course, at the time, for a certain amount of time, received support from the CIA to undermine the Batista regime. And then when the time came, they flipped. We've seen this done, played out with Colonel Gaddafi and other regimes, Assad. And so they flipped, and then he became sort of the the boogeyman of the Caribbean, because it served again, having that person, having him in the Caribbean, being so close to the United States, was a great way to again create another threat, to create a pretext for some of the dirty wars or operations that occurred in the 1980s in Central America, El Salvador, Nicaragua. And of course, when all this is going on, he's dispatching 100,000 troops to Angola in that civil war. Many of them are used to protect oil rigs, oil fields of Gulf Oil and BP. You know,
yeah, Castro, I think was,
or Chevron rather. I think it was Chevron. But again, here he is, a communist. He's communist troops are protecting the property of Chevron.
Look, with Castro, I mean, the thing is, I always thought he was. Once I sort of the bit flipped in my mind and I realized that they were using stagecraft as propaganda, you know, constantly, Castro just immediately became, an obvious, you could see how once you got that kind of perspective of him, you can see how logical it all was. I mean, look at his outfit.
Yeah, I know. The beard.
He shows up in New York in military fatigues and a beard to scream at the U.S. I mean, what? You know, is this real or is this just something? Again, it's just a commie boogeyman.
Is this when he sires Trudeau, the current Prime Minister of Canada?
Well, you know, these are the rumors, but
yeah, he looks like Castro.
Yeah, it could be. You know, in Havana, which I was, I
Justin
actually,
Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's dad, yeah,
Justin Trudeau. Yeah, well, you know, the rumor, at least on the street, is that, which I was surprised at, is that Castro's family is Jewish.
Yes, I've heard that too.
I was unaware of that. And then when I was in Castro and I was asking people about him, they just matter of fact, it was like almost something that people in the street just sort of accepted.
His father was a wealthy landowner, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so
Converso family, yeah.
And so that's the thing, is that it was a Converso family, and that's how, you know, and he was in a Masonic, and he ends up in, you know, in the UN screaming about, Marxist revolution that's going to, you know, swamp the United States, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, yeah, I mean, it's just the whole atomic age. I kind of wonder, they talk about nuclear waste. That was something I was curious what your opinion was about that. Is that
that guy, Galen Windsor, who talks about
something. Yeah.
That's interesting, yeah.
What do you think about that? Because, you know, you look at like Fukushima or Chernobyl.
Yeah, it's now it's thriving.
Right. Well, the question
is, or the Bikini Atoll or Nagasaki and Hiroshima, right? I mean.
Right. Exactly. So it's just kind of, I mean, the physics is out of my pay grade.
Yeah, according to Galen Windsor, again, this is above my pay grade, but again, and this is the problem of living in a scientific dictatorship, is they have occulted knowledge and they're willing to manipulate or give you bad information. And His idea was that this is a way of just running up costs, needless safety costs, and also creating false scarcity. Basically, you get the same theories in regards to what's his name about the energy in the atmosphere.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, Van Allen. Yeah.
No, you know the guy who does. You know the guy who who's the guy who you know who ace you know, who went against the. Early 20th century, died in 1943.
Gosh, you know, you're
now my brain's anyway. You're getting these air. The idea, Galen Windsor says that all the precautions, these things, Three Mile Island was a hoax, and that's considering the fact that Three Mile Island occurred roughly the same time that the China Syndrome movie came out. Talk about a coincidence.
When Hollywood backs up a historical event almost too quick to be, like kind of believable, that's one of the, you know, I mean, that's it's sort of like the movie Pearl Harbor being released like just before 9/11 was, you know,
he claims the radiation illness really isn't, it's from the initial blast, the effects that it has, whereas the long lasting things,
but they talk about the nuclear waste, which makes, you know, it's like, again, it's over my pay grade, but it does make sense that there would be waste.
By the way, Tesla.
Tesla, of course.
Yeah, don't you drive a Tesla?
I'm Teslaing at a Tesla. I'm staring at my Tesla car right now.
Yes, I'm thinking.
My little.
That's the mind for you, right?
There it is. There's a perfect example.
Tesla.
But
you, you own the freaking car, don't you?
Yes, I do, in fact. Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I mean, the whole idea that there's radiation sickness in these things, yeah. And that guy, Galen Winter, who lived into his 80s, by the way. He didn't die of cancer. Yeah. So.
Yeah, my question is, it's like all the waste, do you think that's real?
I have no reason just to take it at face value. I wouldn't sip it. I wouldn't lick it like he did, but it makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly possible. I just don't know. And again, this is like one of the problems, like, as you pointed out, of living in a world where the elite control the scientific reality.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the outside looking in, and you get things like the moon landing, and you have to like kind of piece reality together analytically, because that's all you can do. You don't really have, so I don't know. I know that
Well, here's the thing, like, the fakery of this. To what extent are we talking about it? Like I said, when we talk about nuclear bombs not existing, or do they not exist in the way that we've been told? Do hydrogen bombs actually work? Right?
Yeah, wow. And is that just a super terror idea?
Yeah.
Or and did they build a couple and then not build any more? I mean, they certainly didn't need to build any more if they were going to operate just a fake dielectric for terror.
Yeah, why do that? And so all we have is Hollywood, and it's pretty clear that the testing films that we do see are fake. I mean, the models, and they don't seem to make any sense. How does a camera survive a nuclear blast?
Right. I mean, obviously there's, there's just a ton of fakery that is for the purpose of propaganda, but the reality, I'm afraid is hidden to us, and I don't really know how to resolve that.
I mean, I like the idea of them being a complete hoax, and so we don't have to do that. Civilization can't be destroyed in an afternoon. That the psychopaths that run the government, that run the control system, don't have the power at their fingertips to destroy civilization or wipe out most of humanity. They don't have to rely on their competence or their sanity to keep us safe from nuclear annihilation. I love that idea. And
yeah,
again,
I absolutely do. And I kind of think that we should operate in terms of being civilians as though that concept is real.
Yeah, because it is. It
gives us courage, to actually try to basically defend ourselves.
Yeah, and nuclear bombs were never designed to protect us. They were designed, as you said, they weren't a defense measure. They weren't needed, even based on the official narrative. We hear stories about the Tsar bomb or this bomb that can destroy this an area the size of Texas. That's a little. I just don't believe that. I'm sorry. How do you test something? To me, first of all, how do you test that?
You'd use a small, little, tiny model of Texas.
Yeah, then you extrapolate or something.
Yeah. We need to operate outside of terror, because terror makes us stupid. And so,
I mean, think about how most people understand nuclear warfare is through the movies. It's the Terminator series, right? War Games. It's the day after, and this is people's perceptions of how this
it's
is.
It's funny. You have like a much higher. I think one of the reasons why you have a higher quality mind than mine is you have better nuclear disaster movies that you grew up. I had like the Attack of the Killer Ants. And they were near a nuclear test site, and the next thing you know, these suckers are like 15 feet tall.
Yeah, yeah.
And breaking into your den, and you have to so these were pretty pitiful in terms of special effects, but man, they scared the crap out of us. And so that now they're much more sophisticated. They're like alien typically. They'll have all kinds of so I think you have maybe a higher quality of terror at this point, than in my period, but it still scares, and we still have to find a way to resist it. I think that the best, position for the citizen is just to say the hell with it. Look, if they have, what do they claim? Like 36,000 nuclear weapons. In the United States. I mean, just some preposterous number. If they actually have this, and if they have the will to use them, so what? It just means that the experiment in consciousness that the planet developed failed. And that's just too bad. But the idea of like giving up your humanity because of fear over these things is really clearly a mistake, right? You need to resist. And so, because what is the point of not resisting? You end up in the same place. So fight and pretend, or at least believe, that the society is made up of simply men who are clever and evil and have learned how to scare you.
Mm-hmm.
And the response is, don't be afraid. I mean, that to me, that's the real lesson of the atomic age, is to just not be afraid. I think you should laugh at these things, because they are kind of, I mean, if you think about a nuclear bomb, I mean, if just from the kind of existential position, it is preposterous. You know, you're talking about wiping out, you know, 100 square miles of humanity at one time. But that's literally, you know, in an instant, well, so what? You're gone, right? You know, I mean, if they can do it, they can do it. In the meantime, just resist with everything you got, you know? And if we create resistance in an international forum, then they're going to have a hard time blowing us all up, because, you know, at some point the planet will fail to function biologically. And so that's really the price we should demand,
mm-hmm.
right? If we're going to go down, we should say, okay, well, we're going to just go down all the way.
And the progenitor of this stuff isn't sovereignty. It isn't, you know, your country. It isn't the fact that, you know, that there are sovereign states out there, governments that are accountable to a local group of people. And if, you know, as bad as governments are, just think of a global government along the designs of like an H.G. Wells and his cabal.
Yeah.
The type of system they want to impose, that they, you know, they've worked to impose on you.
That's a really good point, Jim. And that's actually how people should, they should look at that literature, because during that period, the Masonic authors really gave us a glimpse to the future, like Brave New World and the H.G. Wells stuff mm-hmm. really shows you where we're headed, to this technologic dictatorship. And they actually lay out to you like the intellectual stratification.
Did you ever see the movie Shape of Things to Come, made in the 30s?
Yes.
And they, I mean, the movie foretells like the Battle of Britain and these things, but you know how it, again, a universal peace is established by coercion, by a higher government, you know. And
yeah, the Shape of Things to Come is really a great that is the position that the humanity should have, you know, against the secret society, is that that's where they want to take us. So if they're going to take you all the way into where you basically have no soul, what do you have to lose?
Mm-hmm.
We have to fight now. You know, when you look at the autism, the first thing the citizen should be, you know, reacting to is that is them developing their, you know, Delta and Epsilon class.
Yeah, while you're worried about nuclear proliferation, they're there,
yeah.
You know, creating generations of autistic, you know.
Well, the slaves, you know. I mean, yeah. they're going to be sex slaves and house servants, and so, you know, since that's the future and it's completely void of any value to, you know, the humanity we represent today,
mm-hmm.
let's just fight. Let's just resist it. Absolutely, don't put up with any of this stuff. You know, kind of in line with the atomic age terror. I mean, now you have the terror of like measles. Right.
But what's weird is people are more afraid of measles than they are of atomic weaponry. There's more stories about measles outbreaks than are about nuclear proliferation.
There was in our local editorial, there was an editorial from this guy, Thomas Elias, and it was, the title of it was that like measles outbreaks and anti-Semitism stem from the same source. I'm serious. This was like the you know, rational discourse that we woke up on Sunday morning in our editorial page.
So I guess those who express skepticism towards inordinate Jewish influence and also the vaccine regime and giving,
I'm skeptical about that, are from the same kind of bad place in the heart, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's so. So I think that Let us not be afraid of the terror weapons, Tim. I mean, they can blow us up, but they shouldn't be able to terrorize us. Terror, that belongs to us. We can control that. You
Yeah.
know, we should really resist that with everything we have. Don't be terrorized. Don't let them herd you into little. I mean, if I could do it over again, man, I wouldn't duck and cover one single time. I would just stand there like at my desk, and I said, "No, I'm not going to do it." And, let everyone else go under their desks. I'm just going to stay here and play with my Godzilla doll.
Well, don't tell Bert the Turtle
I
that.
had one. Everyone had one. They gave them away at school. They
They
was like
did
one of
really? Toy Bert?
yeah, everywhere had Bert the Turtle.
If you still had it, it'd be worth a lot on eBay, probably.
It would, Yeah. So it's yeah. So okay, Tim. Well, it's I guess a good put a pretty good face on it. And happy Mother's Day to all of the powers and principality moms out there.
That's right. Today is Mother's Day. We're recording a little late this week, but today is
Yeah,
Mother's
sorry
Day.
about that. That was my fault. I've been oh, just swept away by all of the different problems in life. And also I had a birthday, which I will talk to you about in private because it was really it's the round number birthday, the dividing between between like kind of existence and the void, So it wasn't so much, you don't get when you turn this number, you don't get like like congratulations, you get like condolences.
I think it was on his 70th birthday. Samuel Clemens said, "Well, it's better than the alternative."
Yeah, I got some of that too, and I actually they were like the people were wondering, like people I know, the younger they go, well, is that correct? What do you think? Now that you're there, but anyway, so
Isn't 70 the new 50?
yeah, well, that's right. I mean, particularly in the Social Security system, where
Yeah.
you want to just stay alive because you have to stay alive for another 8 years to like get some of your money back. But one thing I really like is that from 70, you get these from 70 on, you can get these great kind of like you've seen like the U.S. debt clock that has
Yeah.
all these little it has like a million little numbers and things. Well, they have the same kind of thing for a projected lifespan. So you put in like your weight and your zip code and things, and it goes, well, you have a 59% chance of like being alive in 10 years. And then then they go, well, you put on 4 pounds. You have a 53% chance.
Whoa. So whatever years you have left, they take all the fun out of it,
Just
right?
everything of it, right? Everything of it. No, it just, the thing is, I'm because the good news about, being well, basically nearly dead is you can be very courageous. You
Yes.
see, because there's nothing. I mean, what's to risk? I mean, people. I mean, some of the suggestions I had is like I should strap dynamite onto myself and, go into like the Federal Reserve or something. And I said, well, that would be a crime, so
Yes.
I can't do that. But I mean, these were the kind of suggestions that the, these were comical
Yes,
suggestions,
of
right?
course.
I'm not. I mean, believe me. Yeah, I mean that's I actually get called on that a lot. It's like, yeah, you make jokes about violence. I don't think violence is a terrible idea at this point in the information revolution. It can never succeed or help develop, where we need to go at this point. So for heaven's sakes, stay calm and don't be afraid and don't get old
Yeah,
because if you can avoid it. So you brought.
especially violence in the atomic age. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean that's exactly right. You don't want any of that. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing about I'm just as long as I'm waxing here on this. One thing about being 70 is your senses get extremely keen because you're always on the lookout for death. It's like you have like a chest pain, it's a heart attack. Headache, that's a stroke, stomach ache, that's cancer. I mean you're on the you're very very like on your pins and needles, so you're
You're
but you're
constantly being stalked by wolves.
thank you so much. And
okay.
We'll talk in a week, huh?
Great. Well, happy birthday then.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.